Well, it's the Saturday night craziness just before the even bigger craziness on Tuesday, November 6th. It's a good bit of fun. Just played a little Donnie Iris for you, just not for any particular reason. It doesn't fit the theme of the program tonight at all, just because it kind of sounds good. And it is Saturday, and we got a long way to go. Now, what I'm about to tell you about our next guest, he is a first-time guest. His name is James Roger Brown. His website is thesociologycenter.com. He is called by some the most dangerous mind in North America. James Roger Brown's general field is sociology of knowledge, with specializations in the sociology of intelligence operations, cultural reality models, and how cultures define and relate to the spiritual world. You better strap in pretty tight for this one, because I have the feeling neither of us has heard anything like it. Not over the national airwaves, let alone the galactic ones. James Roger Brown is next on Coast to Coast AM. James Roger Brown has tested Joseph Campbell's conclusion that the spiritual traditions of all cultures are attempts to describe the same spiritual world by testing what they identify as teachable and learnable spiritual skills to determine if those skills can be learned. In the intelligence field, Roger has developed the most advanced methodology that currently exists. One major feature is that it can be applied to any species with a central nervous system. Absolutely amazing in just its description. Welcome to Coast AM, Roger.
Thanks for inviting me on.
I have two of your papers here, A Holographic Paradigm Theory of the Structure and Operation of Social Processes, and then What Americans Need to Know About Death Squads and Model Death Squad Prohibition Legislation, which exists nowhere else. First of all, just tell us, who are you and what led you to this extremely complex field, at least from the standpoint of this observer?
It started with an experience I had in basic training under the Nixon administration. I was called out of formation one morning with another person. We were sent to the Post Theater. This was at Fort Polk, Louisiana. There were a number of men there in civilian suits. They gave us this pitch about needing White House switchboard operators, and that we had been selected because we had college degrees and no criminal record. They went on to describe that if we signed up for this, we would be allowed to live off post, wear civilian clothes, you know, all of the benefits that could legally be given to us. And then it came break time. The man in charge said, if you want to know what this is really about, when you come back, you will have to sign a confidentiality agreement. And at that point, myself and the other person who were selected from our company decided we would go back to the company and not have anything else to do with it. When I got back and was signing in, the drill sergeant at the desk said, so you decided not to go to Washington, huh? You know, in a tone of voice that raised the hackles on the back of your neck.
Right.
And there were actual consequences, unpleasant consequences for saying no. I got curious about that after I got out at the end of my two-year term. I had
was
my
this
congressman
Army?
Look into it.
And was this Army or Marines or what, Roger?
Army, U.S. Army.
Gotcha. Okay.
What my congressman communicated to me was that this was a program Nixon started to select members from a military unit personally loyal to him. It was something similar to the SS, I guess, in the Third Reich.
Okay.
Anyway, when Nixon's administration collapsed, these people went to the foundation of the drug, the DEA. And those were the morons that were raiding the wrong farms in the Midwest and stuff when the DEA first started. And after that, I developed curiosity in intelligence operations and covert programs that were nefarious enterprises. And my master's thesis was a cross-national study of intelligence operations in World War II, which led to some further bizarre experiences. One of the things that you have to do is provide printed copies that are bound to the university library. One goes to the Library of Congress, and less than a week after my printed copy was put in the library at Memphis State University, where I was attending at the time, I was sitting on a bench in front of the library, and a gentleman walked up to me and said, my name, you wrote a book on intelligence operations, didn't you? I said, yes. In the library now. He said, yes, I just read it, and proceeded to have a conversation with me that ended with a threat that I wouldn't live longer than 2 weeks if I didn't come to work for the CIA. And I've had similar experiences on numerous occasions since then. And what I did with my skills that were developing from that, I helped protect missionaries that were abroad from being assassinated and their mission programs from being corrupted by penetration by either Soviet or American intelligence, so that they were, you know, legitimate missionary programs. And I designed the strategy and tactics that Reverend Ed Roop used to get the approval of both the Clinton and Cuban governments during the Clinton administration, and the total ban on trade or visits. Anyway, following my recommendations, he got the approval of both the United States and Cuban governments, and I think took three shipments of medical and other supplies and distributed them to the Cuban people. So those are the kinds of things that I did with the skills that I was developing. And because of that, you know, I literally had to have methods and procedures that worked, because I needed to keep myself alive and the people I was protecting too. So I had to, you know, develop new methodology for virtually everything. And I, you know, most of the, and it still is, most of the science and sociology theories and stuff are worthless. What I developed is based on how natural processes work. I solved the problem of how to mathematically describe social processes using neural structures as the unit of analysis.
Now, before you go farther, would you tell us, what is your definition of social processes? What do you mean by that?
Well,
so we can track with you.
That's easy. If you anyone gets the book, all of this is described in the book. But basically, social processes, and the reason it's called the holographic paradigm theory is because it's how energy flows through the network of neural structures that exist in the individual, and how individuals initiate and activate the neural structures, which are biological programs in other people, through communication. I even developed a three-dimensional system for mapping how social processes work by mapping out the programs that are activated in another individual. And This is the only sociological theory that has technological applications. A good friend of mine was William Pollack, which you may have heard of. He was a former NSA agent. He's now deceased, but he and I attempted to get some of the technology built, prototypes for doing neural scanning, but the national lab that we approached to do it decided they didn't have the science at the time to do it. It requires a substantial amount of storage space, because you literally have to take a neural scan of the entire central nervous system, non-destructive neural scan. So it was the machinery to do that has not been built yet, but I think we're getting close to the technology where we can do something similar to that. And it's important, because if you're able to scan neural structures, you can literally save languages that are dying out, knowledge that's in terms of skills like blacksmithing that are held by people that are dying and not passing it along to others. So it would be an incredibly powerful tool. You know, you could literally produce a library of skills that would be available in perpetuity. Skills would not be this lost is for, like they are today.
This is for observation, and I presume then control eventually.
Observation and control of what?
Well, if the human being, once you perform a neural scan, then what?
Well, you have a record of what skills they have at that point. One of the things that is contained in the book identifies the optimum properties, and the mathematical description allows this. You can identify what the optimum properties are for a stable civilization, and the optimum civilization would have the situation where individuals learned as much as they could for as long as they could, and you know, there was not the nasty control systems and stuff that we have now, because you have to be able to sustain the existence of the members of your civilization. You can't have incidents like what happened in New York and Louisiana. You have to keep your citizens alive in order to maintain the power of your culture in relation to others.
That is very, very interesting. How is this actually accomplished on a large enough scale to be to enable, well, enable change in an entire society? As a matter of fact, what percentage of your society has to be like-minded for one to be able to say we can define the behavior of this particular social group?
Well, the common elements have to be that everyone speaks a common language, because you have to be able to communicate with other people, and what communication is being able to activate the neural structures in someone else that are the basis for communication. And you know, there were a number of descriptions like that. This is something totally new, and I recommend that everyone get the book. It's available on the publication shopping cart on my website. There is one peculiarity about that. The payment is arranged through PayPal, but I deliver the books as attachments to email. The reason I do that is to have some control over making sure this doesn't end up in the hands of people that
don't need
some
it.
Expect
shouldn't have some, it.
Well, not only shouldn't have it, but the intelligence applications from this may be such that it would get me in trouble if I shipped them overseas. So I try and make sure that they go to United States and Canadian citizens.
Roger, it's of course you are full immersion into your work and have been for several decades, I take it.
Yes.
And you have woven this.
I'm 61 and not going to be around much longer, which is one of the reasons why I'm disclosing these things, and we'll be disclosing some other things in the near future as the crisis develops.
Well, bear with me, because just based on just a cursory examination of your work, it is obvious that it's going to take every brain cell that I have that's still fully functioning to track with you. You have gone from a holographic paradigm visit to Plato's cave, and then in other parts down here, let me see, I just saw something really, really grabbed me. There it is. Intelligence collection and analysis, sensory system divisions. This is amazing. And then I'm looking at another one, and we go all the way to some quotes from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the survivor of the Russian Gulag, for anyone not familiar with him. His Gulag Archipelago sold a bunch of copies. And the mention of death squads. So this is going to be a conversation of some complex structure, but I rely on you to take us through the ramifications of your studies as far as the holograph. I need a clarification on the holographic paradigm for starters.
Well, one of the reasons that you're having trouble with this is because you've never seen anything like this before. What that is a formal statement of a theory like they're supposed to be.
Okay.
It meets the requirements because it builds upon a sequence of logical, if this is true, then type statements.
Yes.
And it's a formal statement of a theory, and it's also intended to meet the Federal Data Quality Act standards, and because I use it in some applications in analyzing evidence in criminal cases, it's designed to meet the standards for science adopted by the United States Supreme Court in Dalbert v. Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, Inc.
So the format that you have presented this in is absolutely by the book, A to Z, complete in the presentation.
Yes, it's a formal theory. Testable, falsifiable, and refutable.
All right. Well, then let me ask you this.
I've never seen anything like it before.
No. It's absolutely baffling. Now, we have 2 minutes before we have to take a little break here, but what's going to be the most, of course, all of this stuff is fascinating, and we have plenty of time tonight since we get ourselves an extra hour. But I say plenty of time, but to explore all of this, but what most people are going to want to understand is, where have your studies, what conclusions have your studies led to in as far as what kind of social fabric we have now, when it's liable to shift into something that we may not recognize? And then we get into this whole death squad thing and the model death squad prohibition legislation, which exists nowhere else. I mean, this is absolutely extraordinary. You have woven this beautiful fabric that goes from mythology to culture to the structure of societies, to the neural structure of the human being that's a part of the... It's just too big. So I rely on you to squeeze it down into something that we can understand, or my brains will be running out of my ears. And what a disgusting visual that is. All right. James Roger Brown, he is our guest tonight. And wait till you hear some of the stuff that he is going to tell you. He has to get the information out. He just said so. And did I mention, don't forget to vote. This is Coast to Coast AM. James Roger Brown writes, organisms experience the physical world as a continuous energy event. When an energy pattern is repeated in the external physical environment and is processed by the biological program formed to process the first occurrence, meaning has developed. So there, when you ask yourself, what is the meaning of this? There's your answer. We'll be right back with James Roger Brown after this. This is Coast to Coast AM. James Roger Brown's book is A Holographic Paradigm Theory of the Structure and Operation of Social Processes, a Unified Field Theory of the Social Sciences. He is a sociologist, intelligence collection, and analysis methodologist. So, now we have an idea of how a human being and a social structure can be studied and analyzed and understood. So, are we prepared to discuss the current state of our particular society, if indeed an American society does exist, or if it's all just variations on the same theme and we're really not all that different at all? In other words, what are we dealing with now? What has happened to us that we need to even discuss what Americans need to know about such a thing as death squads? Are you there, Roger?
Oh, yes. I was waiting for you to finish.
You were waiting for me to shut up. Well, I have. You have the floor.
Perhaps the best way to assist people in understanding the significance of this is to compare it with something they're familiar with. Everyone knows about Einstein's theory of relativity and how it was used as a basis for developing both nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Now, just like Einstein's theory of relativity, you know, it's a theory that has to be understood well enough that you can develop applications from it. Now, yep. just like the relativity theory, my theory has both good and bad applications. If you go the bad route, your civilization will be short-lived because it will self-destruct in short order. It has weapons applications, some of them horrific. So you can use it to develop weapons, or you can use it to develop a stable civilization that sustains all of its members. And it
well, would it serve us at all to even ask what's a vague idea of how such a thing, how this knowledge could be weaponized?
Yes.
Without giving anybody any ideas.
Specifications for some of those. I'll just talk about it in general terms. Say, for example, that you wanted to remove all the lawyers from your culture. If you developed weapons that targeted specific neural structures and programmed into that targeting system the neural structures that would be common to attorneys, then those weapons would seek out attorneys and eliminate them. I'm not going to go into detail on how that could be done, but it can be done, and not very complexly.
So I was close when I made a comment on another program that everybody who is involved in any particular group or endeavor, which would involve other people, will assume a similar mindset. They will each give up a little bit of their individuality to share in the collective of the group. And is this how such targeting could occur? I presume it is.
Well, actually, it's the learned skills. One of the applications that William Pollack and I were looking at would be detecting terrorists. Okay. For example, entering airports with the neural scanning technology. Say, for example, you had a dictionary of the neural structures for getting to a specific camp in Afghanistan where jihadists were trained. You could scan the neural structures of individuals coming into the country, and whenever it found those specific skills, or, for example, the specific skills on how to construct a an improvised destructive device,
right,
you could red light that individual and pull them out for further questioning. Now, obviously, that would catch people with military training plus the terrorists, so you would have to distinguish between the two with further questions. But those would be some of the technological applications.
Doesn't bode well for individual freedoms, does it?
Well, like I said, you know, it can be used for good or bad. And if you did go the bad route and started restricting people, you would quickly get into trouble like we are now, where you are becoming an unsustainable civilization.
Is that what's happening, Roger?
The death squads and other matters. But before we get to that, another example of how this can be applied, how this theory can be applied, is in looking at how social processes work, such as law enforcement. And one of the things that I've done is identify why law enforcement, the criminal justice system, has such a high error rate. There are several different types of hypothesis testing. All of us are familiar with the scientific method because we were introduced to that in high school science.
Sure.
However, there are two other important kinds. There's the type that the police use, which has a high error rate because it is only, for example, if you have five suspects, okay, and you limit your theory of the crime to those five suspects, it only works if one of those is actually the guilty party. Okay. There's another type of hypothesis testing that rather than looking at all nine suspects collectively, if you take each one individually and make a matrix with specific criminal offense and true or false for two hypotheses, you know, this individual is guilty of the criminal offense of, and the second column is he is not guilty. And then you list your individual evidence and check in the box for each one of those columns. And the logical properties of these last hypothesis type is that both cannot be true, both cannot be false. So if you have evidence put forth for these two types of hypotheses, you immediately know that one set of evidence is false, and you can do further analysis to determine which set is false and how it became falsified. That's what is in the book I sent to the PDF review copy of the book I wrote on how to conduct an objective child abuse investigation. I basically took the advanced intelligence analysis methodology that I developed and used it to analyze evidence in criminal cases. I've testified as an expert witness, and I've also used it to identify science fraud. For example, I reverse engineered how the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test 2, which is the most commonly used diagnostic test, is scored and documented that it is rigged to produce false positives. There's no set of answers you can give that would be interpreted as you having no psychological problems. It's basically a fraud tool.
That's interesting.
Well, when you look at the history of how it developed, and for example, Sigmund Freud's personal correspondence indicates that he came to the United States specifically to set up a criminal operation to extract money from Americans. he stated that America was nothing but a nation of savages, and that the only use Americans had was to provide money to psychiatrists. And, you know, it wasn't about benefiting anybody other than the pockets of himself and his cadre of supporters.
And his neural scan would look like what?
Well, you could identify the common criminal skills by looking at their neural structures.
You know, it seems to me like this might be opening the door. I can't remember who said that. This is an old program, a long time ago, but a man predicted that you would one day just go before a computer, and everything that was known and everything that could be scanned would be scanned, and there wouldn't be any more human judges or juries. You just go before this thing, the information would be there, and it would make the determination as to what to do with you.
Well, I'm one who certainly does not hope that it comes to that.
Well, neither am I, but it sounds possible.
Oh, it's always been possible. You know, one of the things, there's a historian in Britain. I've got a link to his article in the if the people want to take a look at what Americans need to know about death squads, Google that title, and PPJ Gazette, out of the hundreds of thousands of places where that is now posted, that website has the easiest to read format.
How do death squads in any way, shape, or form apply to us, or could they? Or have they been with us and we just don't know it?
Well, they've been, documented and prosecuted in countries like Chile, Argentina, Cambodia, but they are new to America as a process of our own government. Now, there have been instances in the past where elements in our government have allowed the intelligence services of foreign nations to come in and kill their own and American citizens. For example, the Chileans killed a Chilean accountant and a woman named Ronnie Moffat, who was riding in his car at the time. She was his assistant. He was documenting the fraudulent use of international funds that were sent to Chile by the junta that was in power. That's why he was an inconvenience to them. But the Israelis have been allowed to come here and kill American citizens. So it's not a new phenomena. But one of the things that I discovered in doing the research to identify what Americans needed to know about the threat was that nowhere in any of the countries that have had the problem, United Nations, nowhere could I find any model legislation or laws of any kind for prohibiting the formation of death squads. I have some experience in writing legislation too, so I just went ahead and developed a piece of model legislation with a key feature, the emergency clause. When a piece of legislation is enacted, usually it takes about a year before it goes into effect, unless the emergency clause is inserted, making it take effect immediately upon enactment and signature by the governor. But the importance of this is that, you know, death squads are secret by nature, and if your solution that you think is the best one is John Wayne-ing it with 12 to 15 men in fully armed and body armor on your front doorstep, you've already lost. Your first line of defense needs to be your state border. And the only way to do that is to enact legislation at the state level, giving responsibility for policing the operation of death squads to your state police. Now, obviously, since the federal government, elements within the federal government are responsible for this, they're not going to do anything to protect you. This is an important concept that when I was teaching sociology, I heard my students say the government does this, the government does that. Governments don't do anything. It's the people occupying the decision making and enforcement positions that do either good or bad. And in this case, we need to protect ourselves and further away than your front doorstep. So we need to enact legislation to protect ourselves from death squads by assigning that responsibility to the state police.
You know, a lot of people out there are going, you got to be kidding me. Death squads in the U.S.? But you know, it's not really that far-fetched. I'm beginning to get that urge to ask some really indiscreet questions, but if I do, just say not go in there and we'll go on, and I won't attempt to...
Now, there are some questions I won't answer.
Well, how about...
We'll see there.
Yeah, well, let me ask. We're going to have to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but I was just wondering, how much of the Benghazi incident looks really funny to you?
That was either gross negligence, gross incompetence, or malice. And I have not analyzed that situation in sufficient detail to tell you which one it was.
Okay. That's a fair answer. I appreciate it.
You're
all
welcome.
Right. We have a long title to give you for James Roger Brown's book, but here it is: A Holographic Paradigm Theory of the Structure and Operation of Social Processes. And we'll be back with James Roger Brown in just a minute. Make yourself a proper cup of tea. Trust me, between now and the end of the show, you will learn something you didn't expect to. This is Coast to Coast AM.